It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a right-wing group that rejects feminism and promotes the white race is establishing itself in Wisconsin. We'll get an up-close look from the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. First, there are anywhere from zero to two bosses today at a federal consumer protection agency. There's a dispute between the White House and officials at the agency over who should be the director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. The departing head of the CFPB appointed his successor, Leandra English, who served as deputy director, but President Trump named his own pick for the position, Mick Mulvaney, who currently heads the Office of Management and Budget. Now there's a lawsuit in Washington, D.C. over who actually leads the agency. Jillian White is a senior associate editor at The Atlantic who's been writing on this. Jillian, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's one boss, two boss, and politically speaking, red boss, blue boss. Jillian, how did we get here? How do we have two different people thinking and acting as though they're in charge of this one federal agency?
Yeah, absolutely. So part of this is a question of legality. So when Richard Cordray several weeks ago said that he was going to resign from the Bureau, and he was the Bureau's first director, so this is kind of unprecedented in many ways. When he said he was going to resign, Donald Trump and his administration looked towards what's called the Federal Vacancies Act, which says that the president has the right to appoint somebody to sit in that interim position until someone who is Senate confirmed can be chosen and confirmed by the Senate. So that stipulation only applies usually unless that agency has another process in place, which the CFPB does via Dodd-Frank. The same act that put together the CFPB actually says that in the event that the director is no longer there, that the deputy director should become the acting director until the president can appoint someone new and they can become Senate confirmed. So that's kind of how we ended up with these two different strings. Now, at the time that Richard Cordray announced his resignation the first time and hadn't officially stepped down yet, there was no deputy director. There was an acting deputy director. So that's part of the way that we kind of got into this weird space.
What happened on a practical level today? They both showed up for work?
Yeah. So if you look around the internet, there are lots of pictures of Mick Mulvaney walking in with a bag of Dunkin' Donuts. He was very clearly in the director's office and taking meetings. And Leandra English was also on site.
Now, talk a little bit about what this agency does and why it was created to see what's at stake here.
Yeah, so Dodd-Frank, which was the act that was put in place after the financial crisis, one of the provisions of it was that it created the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And the idea of the Bureau, which was the brainchild of Elizabeth Warren, was that consumers would never be caught in this spot again, that they would never be kind of at the whims of financial institutions. So the Bureau has been responsible for doing things like regulating payday lenders and prepaid cards. They're also in charge of consumer financial education and a host of other things that are meant to kind of strengthen the position of the consumer in the economy.
So, and some of the high-profile stuff they've done is they're the ones who punished Wells Fargo, right, for some of their consumer
Absolutely.
Fraud issues.
Yeah, so one of the big things that they do is that they bring lawsuits against financial operations that they believe to have been bad actors. So we're talking about some of the credit rating agencies and also Wells Fargo and a few others.
And President Trump and Mick Mulvaney and many Republicans have been very critical of this agency. Why haven't they liked it?
So pretty much since the inception of the CFPB, Republicans have come out against it. They think that the structure is unconstitutional. Part of the interesting thing about the CFPB is that their money does not come from Congress. It actually comes from the Fed. So they're very independent. And having the president as the only person who can appoint their leader kind of gives them even more independence. And that was done intentionally. The CFPB was supposed to not be at the whims of any particular politician or political sway. And I guess Republicans have always had a bit of an issue with that, have always felt that they should be subject to congressional appropriation. And some Republicans who really don't like the Bureau have always said that it's actually more harmful to the financial industry than it is helpful.
We're talking to Jillian White, senior associate editor at The Atlantic, talking about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. It has two bosses, depending on who you talk to, one appointed by the president, one appointed by the outgoing director of the agency. Where are we now? Are the courts going to decide this ultimately?
So it remains to be seen. Of course, somebody could always give and decide that they don't want to stake a claim in this anymore. But right now, it seems that it will go to court. So the first hearing on this is today at 4:30 Eastern time. And right now, they are hearing what is Leandra English's complaint against Donald Trump, saying that he does not have the right to appoint the next interim director. So that's where we are.
And it makes a big difference if it's Mick Mulvaney or Leandra English, right? They presumably, given their backgrounds, would have a very different approach to consumer financial protection.
Yeah, absolutely. So people see Leandra English as kind of the continuation of what Richard Cordray was doing, kind of focused on the same thing, a lot of aggressive enforcement, whereas Mick Mulvaney, both because he is an appointee of the Trump administration and also because of what he has done at the OMB, would likely fall in line behind deregulation and kind of tamping down some of the more aggressive things that the Bureau has done.
Right. Mick Mulvaney has called this agency a sick, sad joke in the past. Do we know what he disliked about it?
Well, some of the things that most Republicans have not liked, he said that they have not truly helped consumers, that is really staunch growth in the financial sector, and that basically all of the consumer protections that the agency purported to offer, that it really didn't. So that really wasn't helping anyone at all.
Are there efforts in Congress to just get rid of the CFPB and get to the bottom of all these questions, given that Republicans are in control of Congress?
Yeah, so there have been lawsuits before filed to say that the entire structure is unconstitutional. And earlier in his campaign, Donald Trump actually said that he would totally get rid of the CFPB. Since then, he had kind of pared that down. But yeah, there have definitely been pushes in the past that have said that the CFPB should be almost completely gutted.
Are there ongoing enforcement actions that the CFPB is involved in that might be on stake here or at stake here?
Yeah, so the CFPB has been looking into a lot of different things. And already Trump has moved to kind of gut one of the things that it still had pending, which was mandatory arbitration clauses, getting rid of those. So there's a lot of ongoing work and a lot of things that they were still doing research on that could potentially be hampered or outright done away with.
I want to follow some of the other threads here. Mulvaney now in charge of this, at least for the time being. Does that mean he keeps his job as head of the Office of Management and Budget, or does he have to move on and they need an interim over there?
So actually, he's allowed to keep both jobs right now, which was one of the interesting things about when Mulvaney was originally selected by Trump. He's allowed to keep his job as the head of the OMB and also to keep this job as the interim director, if that's what courts decide. When it comes to the CFPB, he wouldn't actually be overseeing day-to-day operations. He would hire somebody else to do that. But again, that person would likely fall into line with kind of his existing belief system about the CFPB.
And presumably take over the Dunkin' Donut duty. And then what happens next? In either case, I mean, either of these people who are showing up for work are interim. What would have to happen to permanently replace Richard Cordray?
Yeah, so at some point, the president will have to choose an actual nominee to become the permanent director, and that person will have to go through Senate confirmation. So the fight now is actually only for a temporary replacement, and then we will see kind of another round of back and forth about who Trump chooses to be the full-time director of the CFPB, and then what senators think of him or her.
And let's talk about Richard Cordray now. His term wasn't up yet until next year, is that right?
Yes, so he decided to leave a little bit early. Many people speculate it's because he wants to run for governor of Ohio. So he backed out a little bit early, resigning officially on Friday.
And he had been a lightning rod for Republican critics of the agency, but just the fact that he's leaving doesn't mean that criticism is going to end, does it?
No, not at all. A huge reason that people disliked Richard Cordray wasn't necessarily about Cordray himself. It was about the thing that we talked about before, which is the structure of the CFPB and kind of the leeway that the head of that agency has in determining what it's going to do, how it's going to work, and how aggressive it's going to be. So it's likely that some of those criticisms will also be visited upon the next director.
And you mentioned Elizabeth Warren. Before she was in the Senate, she was one of the big advocates for the creation of this agency. Has she been weighing in on this back and forth now?
So it's pretty clear that Elizabeth Warren thinks that the agency should continue the work that it's already doing and that putting someone like Mick Mulvaney ahead of it could severely hamper it. So it's reasonable to believe that she wants Leandra English or someone who already has kind of similar beliefs as Cordray in that slot.
And as far as people weighing in on who is actually in charge, is it pretty much falling on partisan lines?
It really is. Things are pretty mixed. And right now, academics are saying that it's a little, the law is a little confusing, but at the very least, there seems to be a good case to fight the federal vacancies appointment.
And is there any kind of timeline as to when courts could, as you mentioned, a hearing already today, is this something where it's expected, you know, maybe by the time we're done talking, a decision will be made, or is this something that could drag on for weeks and weeks?
It could honestly be either. So a hearing was scheduled very, very quickly. This lawsuit was filed last night. There's already a hearing this afternoon. That being said, the hearing could be had, and there could be no decision from it. So this could go on for days and days. In her lawsuit, English did ask for a speedy resolution to this, in part because it's causing so much upheaval. But, you know, whether or not that will manifest remains to be seen.
And now we're just seeing a tweet from CBS News. President Trump's choice for the CFPB, Mulvaney, he's put a 30-day hiring freeze at the Consumer Bureau, at this bureau we're talking about, and an immediate halt in any new regulations, rules, and guidance. So all they'll be doing is eating donuts and, I guess, doing anything they were already doing.
Yeah.
Well, we'll leave it there and a lot to watch. Jillian, thanks a lot for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
We've been talking to Jillian White. She's a senior associate editor at The Atlantic. She joined us to look at a dispute between the White House and officials at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau over who is in charge at the agency, a story changing by the minute as we talk about it. Right now, since the 2016 presidential election, groups on the right and left have taken their messages offline and into the street. Violence and protests by members of the conservative alt-right have been met with counter-protests by masked anti-fascists and others. Confrontations have broken out at protests in Berkeley, Portland, Charlottesville, and elsewhere since President Trump came into office. Alexandra Hall reports on one group that's finding ground in Wisconsin.
The Proud Boys have been called many names. What they call themselves is a fraternal organization, or men's club, for libertarians who want to meet up with other like-minded guys and drink beer. Most are young, white, and support President Trump.
And put these two beers and the fries on my tab. Those are my tab. And then
on a recent night at a brewery in a shopping mall just outside of Milwaukee, three men order a round of beers.
You boys need another beer? Anybody need a drink?
Eric, Brad, and Patrick are all members of the Proud Boys from Southeast Wisconsin and Chicago. They ask that we not disclose their last names because they fear violent attacks on their members. Eric and Brad are both wearing the black and yellow Fred Perry polo shirts the Proud Boys are known for.
Proud Boys were coming up on just various online articles and sites and whatnot. So I decided to dig into it a little bit.
That's Eric. He's the president of the Wisconsin chapter of the Proud Boys. He says when he found out about the group earlier this year, he looked for a chapter to join in Wisconsin. At that point, one didn't even exist yet. So he started it.
I liked what I saw, basically. I liked that they weren't a white supremacist, white nationalist group, but they weren't trying to appease the left.
The Proud Boys have a lengthy list of causes. They include ending the war on drugs, giving everyone a gun, glorifying housewives and entrepreneurs, and declaring the West is the best. The first step to becoming a Proud Boy is saying you're a proud Western chauvinist who refuses to apologize for creating the modern world. Second degree, as you can hear in this YouTube video, involves getting punched by other guys while you try to name five breakfast cereals.
One, Cheerios, two, Frosted Flakes, three, Cocoa Puffs, four.
Third degree is getting a Proud Boy tattoo, and if you get into a fight with Antifa, the sometimes violent anti-fascist activists, you're an honorary fourth degree. When you get down to it, Eric, Brad, and Patrick say it's about free speech for everybody. Even the white nationalists who organized the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville. Brad says even though they don't agree with those groups, they had a permit to be there and a right to express their views.
We have a platform. Black Lives Matter has a platform. And you know, I'm sorry for people that don't like it, but the Ku Klux Klan and the neo-Nazis have a platform. That's free speech.
But the guys say this isn't about race. They think the left and identity politics have gone too far in trying not to offend anyone.
And we're done apologizing. None of us knew anybody that owned a slave. Personally, my family didn't emigrate here until the First World War. I share no white guilt. So I'm done being villainized as the white devil. I'm not him.
The Proud Boys' ideas are kind of all over the place. One thing they all believe in, though, is what they call Western values.
The West is about you doing it your own way and not being hindered by rules.
That's Gavin McGinnis. He was one of the co-founders of Vice Media. Since then, he's hosted a series of right-wing online talk shows. Last year, at the height of the presidential election, he founded the Proud Boys as a space where guys could be guys. He says he got the idea for Western values from reading Pat Buchanan's 2002 book, The Death of the West, how dying populations and immigrant invasions imperil our country and civilization. McKinnis says it was Trump's anti-political correctness that drew him in. He says there was this one moment when he knew Trump was his kind of politician.
What really did it for me was he was doing a press conference and they said, he was saying anchor baby, and some Hispanic journalist said,
"Are you aware that the term anchor baby, that's an offensive term? People find that hurtful."
You mean it's not politically correct, and yet everybody uses it?
Look it up in the dictionary.
So
it's offensive.
Give me a different term. Give me a different term. What else would you like to say?
The child, the American-born child of an undocumented immigrant.
You want me to say that? Okay. I'll use the word anchor baby.
I'm saying,
Excuse me. Why
do you have to use that phrase?
I'll use the word anchor baby.
And he sort of gave him this sort of gesture with his arm, like, you know, shoot him away. And I thought, oh, my God, we finally have a president who talks the way we all talk and is a human being, a non-politician politician.
McKinnis says that the media have overblown the actual scale and presence of white supremacists in the U.S., but he's open about his own feelings towards Muslims and women. His Twitter profile describes him as anti-Islam, and he talks on his show about how most women would be happier at home than in the workplace.
I would say feminism was done in maybe 1979. And since then, it's just been women inventing problems and lying to create a world where the feminists are needed, like saying one in four women will be sexually assaulted or raped in college, or saying that women earn less than men and there's a wage gap, like just blatant lies to justify their existence.
McKinnis says those are his views. You don't have to share them to join the Proud Boys, but they resonate with the guys.
The wage gap, predicated on a myth, verifiably false. And in some job fields, women are making more than their male counterparts.
Some have called the Proud Boys the alt-light, including those within the nationalist alt-right movement.
For our purposes here, I think you could define the alt-light as those who align themselves with the politics of the alt-right in the era of Trump without really addressing or associating with any issues of race or, you know, race or racism.
Ryan Lenz is a senior investigative writer with the Southern Poverty Law Center. Every year, the organization publishes a report on the groups espousing extremist ideas in the U.S. He says groups like the Proud Boys use humor and irony as a tool of plausible deniability.
If someone were to become critical of the Proud Boys, all they'd have to do is look to the process by which one becomes a Proud Boy, and they could say, look, you guys are stupid. You're actually taking this as face value and thinking we're a threat. So it's this weird sort of thing. You don't know if it's actually real or if it's a joke. But I'll tell you this, like in the streets, like, you know, during these alt-right rallies, when the Proud Boys show up, you know, to defend the First Amendment principles of racists and extremists, you know, that is not a joke. It's very real and very serious.
In May, a member of the Proud Boys was ambushed and beaten in downtown Madison. According to police records, the victim said he believed the perpetrators were Antifa. Last month, a UW-Madison grad student, who the Proud Boys were vetting as a possible new member, agreed to give up his teaching duties after a blog post alleged he had a history of spreading racist and anti-Semitic messages at another university. Again, Ryan Lenz.
The reality is that the ideologies that people, you know, people have who gravitate toward being a Proud Boy, you know, the ideologies of anti-Islam, as Gavin has on his Twitter page, or, you know, or anti-feminism, these are things that play deeply into the grains of the alt-right.
As of now, researchers at the Southern Poverty Law Center have not designated the Proud Boys a hate group, although they're considering them for next year's report. One of the reasons is that the group is so new. They're still waiting to see what the Proud Boys become. Alexandra Hall, Wisconsin Public Radio.
That story was produced in collaboration with the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. First, there's been a national conversation about sexual harassment and assault over the last few weeks in the United States. It started back in early October with a New York Times story detailing decades of allegations of sexual harassment and assault against film producer Harvey Weinstein. Since then, many women have come forward to share their stories of sexual harassment and assault with the hashtag MeToo. There are also several prominent men facing accusations now in the worlds of entertainment, politics, media, and beyond. Our next guest says that while the conversation now is focused on misogyny and unequal treatment of women in the workplace, it can start with the subtle gender dynamics at home. Darcy Lockman is a clinical psychologist in New York City who's working on a book about the gendered division of labor in childcare. Darcy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you write recently, and you're working on a book on this, that a lot of the problems we see now in the workplace and elsewhere, it starts at a very early age with kids seeing how their parents deal with childcare. So what kind of things are you looking at?
Well, the gender division of childcare labor hasn't moved in the last 20 years. So when women initially went into the workplace in droves in the 70s, 80s, and through the 90s, men started doing more at home to compensate. But the division got stuck at about 35-65. So even when both parents are employed full-time, women do about 65% of the childcare work. And children observe this. You know, they see their moms kind of rushing around packing lunches while their dads read Facebook on their phones. And it does make an impression on them.
And you say it doesn't matter what the parents' ideology is, their worldview, what they think. The important thing that the kid sees is how they behave.
Yeah, kids pick up on behavior. I mean, there are certainly couples who decide to live in more traditional ways. There are also couples who really, their ideology would support living in more progressive ways. They never have conversations about how it will go. And then the women end up picking most of the slack. And people tell me it just feels like the natural thing. And children see that and then learn what gender is more valuable, which is different than more valued. I've had people respond to the article saying, but, you know, children really value their mothers. And certainly I believe that they do. But when you see your mother doing all the work while your father relaxes, there is something conveyed about which gender's time is more important, who serves and who gets served. And that does communicate something to kids.
Talk some more about how this plays out. In a two-parent family, a male and female husband and wife in a household, how do things shake out, as you've seen in surveys and in talking to families?
Well, the tiniest studies all show that women do a lot more and are a lot more upset about the imbalance. Men tend to not notice it as much. Women do a lot of what is called invisible labor, planning the child care, signing up for extracurricular activities, buying food for the lunches for the week, stuff that dads don't even necessarily notice is going on behind the scenes. So women end up feeling really saddled with this stuff. Men end up not noticing. And division of labor of childcare is actually the biggest point of contention, research has shown, for couples after they have kids.
What do men think? Do men, when surveyed, think, pretty much 50-50?
They often do, because the surveys will often say, do you think things are equal in your home? And far, like 20% more men than women say, yeah, things are pretty equal. Another interesting study found that they asked men and women, you know, how much work do you do? And they divvied it up. And then they asked them separately, are things fair in your house? And what they found was the men who said things were fair were doing about 36% of the labor at home. So that's what they deemed fair. It wasn't that they knew they were doing 36% and they said that was fair. It was that they just estimated that things were about fair. Something interesting that corresponds to that was women agreed. So they looked at the time use studies and they said to women, oh, are things fair in your home? And as long as men were doing about that much, it was lower, it was 34%. As long as their husbands were doing 34%, women deemed that fair. So even beyond the women who are dissatisfied with what's going on, the women who are satisfied, their husbands are doing about 36%, which may explain why the number's been stuck at 65-35 for so many years.
But you've also talked to women and seen a lot of frustration out there with this, even maybe if they think it's fair. I don't know. Where does that come in, where they might think it's fair, the women, even with this imbalance, and yet many are frustrated?
Yes. Well, I think the ones who think it's fair aren't the same ones okay. who are frustrated. So my book actually grew out of my own personal experience. I was really surprised how things played out once my husband and I had kids. I thought, you know, we're pretty progressive, we're pretty liberal, we met in grad school, we were both clearly going to have careers. I was never going to be a stay-at-home mother. It was neither an option nor something that I wanted. And yet, everything started falling to me once we had children, and it got even worse once we had two kids. And so I started looking into all the research, and I was amazed by the social science research, because it was one thing for me and my friends to be complaining to each other. It was another to read academics in journals actually writing the sentence, "Why do men do so little?" I mean, that's not a sentence you expect to read in an academic journal, or at least I wasn't before I started looking into this. So once I started doing the research and there was all this support for it, in academia, I started soliciting women to talk about it. So I was actually asking for women who had particular issues in this area. So the women I was talking to were primarily frustrated, because I asked for frustrated women. So I'm not doing anything where I determine what percentage of women are frustrated. I'm simply talking to women who are, and again, relying on the statistics to show the imbalance and how it's been maintained over so many years.
Talking to Darcy Lockman. She's a clinical psychologist. She's working on a book about the division of labor by gender in childcare and how it affects future generations. Before we get to those future generations, Darcy, I want to figure out where this comes from, because I'm betting if I could go back in time and ask you and your husband before you got married, hey, are you going to have a really unfair division of labor in childcare? Is that what you're planning on? You would have both said no, right?
We would have said no, but we weren't paying attention, because even when we started living together, the way things shook out was, you know, my husband said when we lived in together, I'll do the dusting and the vacuuming. I really like doing those things. And that left me with the bathroom and the kitchen, and we were living in a one-bedroom apartment. So already it's like, wait, I don't want to clean the bathroom and the kitchen, but I didn't say anything, because I had this thought in the back of my head, and I still remember this so clearly, that I was really lucky that he wanted to do anything at all. And it's almost embarrassing to admit that out loud, but we live with the knowledge of a not-so-distant past in which really nothing was expected of men at home. And I think that it still looms large, even though our values now are more progressive.
All right, now let's get into part two, how this affects the kids. This division of labor is there. It's unbalanced. What are kids seeing? What are they learning?
Well, what I fear with my children, and what, you know, I have two daughters, and what a lot of the women that I've spoken to are concerned about, is that, you know, either the girls expect to be subservient to men, and the boys learn that their needs and aspirations are more important than their female counterparts. So, and then the cycle continues. You know, we live in a culture that really undervalues women so much, and I think part of the reason we see so much sexual harassment in the workplace that's coming out now is because we undervalue women. You know, men think it's okay, it's part of their privilege. Clearly not all men. Most men do not sexually harass, obviously. But the ones who do, there's some assumption of privilege. I can touch women in any way that I want because I'm more important. Women aren't really people. So I think those of us who think about it in our homes worry that our children on some level take that on. Not that they will become criminals or sexual harassers, but that this will continue to play out in homes over time. And it does have a really deleterious effect on marriages, on children, on women's capacity to be earners, which at a very basic level they need to be. Marriages don't always last. Circumstances change. Women need to be able to earn money. And this really gets in the way of earning potential over time as well as everything else.
So if there's a family listening right now, let's start with the guy. There's a guy listening right now thinking, well, I would say I'm one of those guys who's pretty close to 50-50 and fair. What would you say to them to start trying to move the needle on this?
You know, men, this word that's so alive in our culture right now, which is privilege, men really need to examine their privilege, which we know now is very, you know, very cliche. It's invisible to those who have it. But, you know, the things that women talk about going on, I had a woman tell me about needing to find last-minute childcare for spring break. Her school usually ran a program. They canceled it at the last minute. She and her husband both got the email about the cancellation, but she spent a week kind of going crazy trying to find something because she and her husband needed to be at work while the kids were on spring break. She found something. You know, again, he had gotten the email too, but she had done all the work to find it, and they were at a children's birthday party the Sunday before spring break, and she was talking to another mother about what she was going to be doing with her kids that week, and her husband said, oh, it's spring break this week? So that's the kind of, that is privilege, right? He's the one who doesn't need to know. Mom really takes care of everything behind the scenes. So I think men need to ask themselves how much of that is going on in their home. Because probably, you know, at least what the research shows is more of it is likely going on than they know.
We're talking to clinical psychologist Darcy Lockman about how children learn, she says, to undervalue women in part from seeing the way their parents divvy up the childcare, the workload, the physical stuff, and that planning and logistics stuff, too. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How does this work out in your home right now, or how about in your home when you grew up? And what do you think of our guest's idea that, you know, seeing this unequal distribution of labor in the house makes kids view women as subservient to men? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up a conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our discussion with clinical psychologist Darcy Lockman about the way men and women divvy up childcare duties at home. She says women do most of the work, and ultimately, kids learn because of that to undervalue women. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do things work in your household? Have things changed over time, maybe between generations in your family? What do you think this does to kids in the long run? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Right to your calls now. Keith is with us in Milwaukee. Keith, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My comment was that I'm wondering if we are making progress, and it sounds like in a lot of cases men still kind of are not doing as much at home, but at least for me, in my generation, I know my wife does more with planning and especially with the kids, but I'm more involved than, say, my wife's parents or my wife's dad is. I know he didn't do very much at all as far as that go. I was just wondering what your guests thought about that. Like, are we making progress? Still more room to go, obviously.
Keith, thanks for the call. Darcy, what do you think?
Yeah, I really appreciate the point he's making. It's true. This generation of fathers does so much more than their dads and are a lot more involved. And I think that's part of why men today often feel that, like, what is going on at home is more equal than their wives do, because they're comparing themselves to their fathers. Their wives are comparing them to themselves. You know, he's not as involved as I am. So there's kind of a different control group. So progress has been made, but it's been stalled for the last 20 years. That's what I would say. And part of that stalling is exactly because men, you know, 25, 30 years ago, really were not particularly involved fathers.
Keith, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Lydia in Manitowoc. Lydia, hi.
Hi. So I'm calling because I had an interesting conversation with my great-granddaughter when I was to see her in Milwaukee. She just brought out of the blue, she brought up the fact that her mother has to get all three kids ready, and she has so much to do in the morning, and her stepfather will not get up and help her mom.
And how old is your great-granddaughter, Lydia?
She is 5, and she's picking up on the mom having to do all this and the dad not helping.
Thanks for the call, Lydia. Darcy, as you write, it had been saying kids notice.
But yeah, they really do. Kids are struggling to make sense of their world, and gender is a big part of their world. We separate them from, you know, prenatally into boys and girls, and from the minute they're in preschool, they're divided into boys and girls. They know they belong to a group, and they work to kind of go along with the standards of that group. So it's really, there are some interesting studies. They study children playing with toys. When kids are alone, they're pretty much equally interested in what we would call stereotypical girl and boy toys. They'll play with both. But when there's another child or an observer around, they're far more reluctant to play with toys that are not for that gender. Kids are really invested in doing the right thing. They learn the rules of their culture and they follow them. So because that's their goal, you know, kind of implicitly, is to learn the rules of their culture, they take in what goes around, they take in what goes on in their homes to figure out where they're going to fit in.
And it's really easy to underestimate how much they're learning, right, and how much they're absorbing lessons from things that we don't even think of as lessons.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they learn from what they see, not from what we tell them.
Go back to our callers now. Sarah is on the line in Eau Claire. Sarah, hi.
Hi. Yes, I grew up in a household where with parents where my mom did most everything, my dad did very little. And that's in part because my mom just tends to take control and, you know, she even if she'll complain about doing too much, she just tends to do it. I'm that way, you know, as well, and I'm about to become a first-time mom, and I'm just kind of curious, any words of advice of how to maybe avoid falling into that almost trap where I'm doing everything and my husband is doing very little, even if I have that tendency to take control.
I'm so glad you're asking. Stop doing that. There's a snowball effect. So the more you do, the less your husband learns, the less your partner learns, and the less he learns to feel capable, which, by the way, he is. Men are biologically primed to parent in the same exact way that women are. There is no maternal instinct. Parenting is learned behavior, and both parents need to learn to do it. Mothers tend to be quicker to respond to children. And actually, this is one of the only biological differences that they've found is that, so if you could follow this kind of complicated story, they've played audio tapes of infants in pain to men and women. They actually tape record boys being circumcised. They play these recordings to new parents. Both men and women are equally physiologically responsive to pain cries. They've also recorded fussiness cries, and what they've found is that women are more physiologically responsive to fussiness cries than men. So there's this anthropologist named Sarah Hardy who posits that it's really that small innate difference that gets so blown up because women early on will respond to fussiness more carefully. Over time, they learn to respond to it better than men do because they're always doing it. And the snowball effect from there is that eventually you're the only one making pediatrician appointments and calling babysitters and filling out the emergency forms, and there are 10 of them every school year. So you really have to nip it in the bud early on. If you can allow your partner the space to learn as you do to parent, those differences really are lessened over time. If the behavior that you label controlling, if you allow yourself to indulge it, you're going to end up really overloaded, especially if you wind up with more than one kid. Trust me.
Sarah, thanks for the call and good luck. We're talking to clinical psychologist Darcy Lockman about division of labor and childcare. Women tend to do more of it than men, even if they both work full time. And she says that has long-term impacts on kids and how they view women. Back to your calls now. Matt is on the line in Waukesha. Matt, hi.
Hello. I am just picking up my kids from school, actually, right now, so I might get interrupted. But largely, I would agree. I'm mostly an at-home dad, and largely I would agree with your guest that my wife does more of the laundry and the cooking. However, I fill in the gaps with, like, I change the oil in the car. If the plumbing is backed up, I'm kind of taking care of more of the mechanical stuff, which I know fits, like, the stereotypical gender sort of roles. But I just kind of was curious how that factors in as far as the, you know, I haven't heard of this conversation if there's crossing over of like the, you know, woman is doing more of the auto maintenance while the guy is taking care of more of the laundry, or just how that all factors into the whole picture.
Matt, thanks. Darcy?
Yeah, that's a great question. The division of labor that I'm looking at is particularly about childcare. So the way the studies break this down is just about childcare. But the studies about other kinds of labor do show that men do more of the outdoor work and women do more of the indoor work in sort of a gender stereotyped way. The thing about something like changing the oil is it's real time limited. It only has to happen. I'm a New Yorker, so I don't know, but I think probably only like once every 3 months, not that often. So the things that men seem to take on are more typically take on are time limited and not ongoing. So, for example, laundry has to be done, you know, with kids every other day, every 3 days. Lunches need to be made every day. So raking the leaves is certainly a difficult activity in the fall, but it happens for a short period of time and then it's done. Women tend to be more in charge of sort of the ongoing, never-ending work of the home.
Matt, thanks a lot for that call. So, Darcy, as we start to look ahead, I mean, as you said, that division has been stalled for a while now. Do you think it's going to start moving again? And if so, in which direction?
Well, I mean, I guess I tend to think that progress is ultimately linear in terms of human rights, civil rights, egalitarian values. But the research doesn't necessarily support that because of this stall. Millennial men do tend to have more egalitarian values than men of prior generations, but they don't seem to be living those once they have children. I don't think that means it's not ever going to shift, but I think we have a lot of myths to debunk about mothering and fathering before equality can happen. We have this idea about what's natural, but people often confuse cultural habit with nature and then assume it can't change. And I think that's partly why we are stuck.
And briefly, if these childhood observations of parents are what are causing some of our problems at the workplace, does that mean we're waiting 20 or 30 years to solve these problems at the workplace?
No, I think it all kind of has to move in conjunction. I think as people are more aware of how male dominance is still sort of our cultural model, there will be small shifts away from it. So, you know, as with a lot of things, I think raising awareness slowly creates change.
We'll leave it there for now. Darcy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Darcy Lockman. She's a clinical psychologist in New York City. She's working on a book about the gendered division of labor and childcare. Her book is due out in 2019. By the way, tonight at 8 on most Ideas Network stations, it's Tribal Histories. At a time when the language and customs of the Potawatomi people are in danger of extinction, we'll find out what tribal elders are doing to preserve their culture for generations to come. Then we hear the prophecy that led the Ojibwe from the East Coast to Wisconsin and told of what they would find here. That's Tribal Histories. You can catch that Monday, that's tonight at 8 on many Ideas Network stations. You can also listen online. Check it out over at WPR.org. Well, it's the Monday after Thanksgiving, and many of us are still dealing with the remains of the day, all the turkey, pie, and other stuff left over from the big meal. Want to hear from you. Do you have a lot of leftovers sitting around? What have you done with them? Is it use or lose at this point for you right now? You can tweet us at Central Time WPR or send us a message on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. Tell us your Thanksgiving leftover story. Been hearing from some of my colleagues, turkey for breakfast the last couple of days, which I could see that working, you know, fried up and of course, I'm a big fan of the turkey stuffing, mashed potatoes and gravy all smooshed together in a pan. I didn't do stuffing this year, so that kills it. And also, we had not that many people. I felt like we made way too much food for Thanksgiving. People mowed. They ate the mashed potatoes. They ate a lot of the sides, the green beans and carrots. Just some turkey left over. And as far as breakfast goes, I went with the pie for breakfast myself, a little bit of pumpkin pie. It is all gone. Temptation removed. Again, share your Thanksgiving leftover story. Email ideas@WPR.org. This is Central Time.